Bill, you must have had a tremendous desire to do what you have done and what you're still doing, and you must have had a deep conviction that it was the right thing for you to be doing. It seems that to do the kind of awakening through service work that you and others do, taking care of the homeless and feeding the hungry, it takes a tremendous amount of energy and commitment. And I'm wondering if you could speak about that a little bit.
I didn't know exactly. I wasn't so secure that I knew what I was striking out to do was the thing.
No.
But I was very clear that I was called to do it, if that makes sense.
Well, you were maybe it wasn't so specific, but it was the general feel that you were to serve.
It was a very strong call. It wasn't that strong about what does it look like. I experimented a lot. I tried a lot of different things. I tried a lot of different jobs. And now I look back and say, well, gosh, I'm glad that didn't work out.
Yeah, right.
You know, because you experiment and say, well, no, it's not that. It's not that. It's not that. But then you finally found something that you feel in harmony with. You know, for me, I loved the poorest of the poor, and I felt a real attunement. You know, I began by serving the homeless on the streets, and developed or just began to recognize a certain, you know, gift I had to be with people. You know, all types of people. I didn't feel scared. I didn't feel threatened. I just felt like I could be a friend. And, you know, over time was able to see through the exterior, you know, of what people presented you. And you could see, you know, at a deeper level.
Well, part of your service must have been through dialogue then, through actually listening and trying to understand that other person.
And I would, you know, say, Hamayat, that the gift of being able to listen, you don't get it in high school, you don't get listening courses in college, you know, you can go get a PhD, you can get speaking classes, but you never get listening classes. And that ability to be with people, you know, where you're open to really listening, not maybe to their words, but what's behind their words, it is a gift that I, over time, realized I had. I don't think that I knew I had it. Nobody had told me I had that, but I had a certain comfort with it that over time I was able, it's like a muscle you keep using and it gets stronger.
And you must really like people.
I do, and I love the diversity of people. You know, and not everybody likes that.
That's,
you know,
right.
In fact,
that's right.
You know, I'd say most people like to be with people just like them.
Yeah.
It's not threatening, and it's familiar, and,
yeah,
you know, I know exactly what they think and say.
Right.
I knew from an early age that that was pretty boring to me.
You wanted to mix it up.
I just felt like, you know, more diversity, I would have a richer life.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, you are, as all people are, a really unique creature, and so in some ways it's really hard to extrapolate from your experience, but in other ways it can be looked at as a universal experience. As you said, everybody has to eat, for instance.
Oh, yeah, Hamayat, I would suggest that I'm not unique at all, you know, but maybe in the fact that I've, you know, grown a big organization, not everybody's been able to do that. But when you look over the last 25 years, when I began with 30 congregations. I have over 500 today. Those 500 weren't doing the work 25 years ago. Okay? So this is really a new movement of this generation, you know, to use congregations and nonprofit groups as service vehicles. So, you know, I think we all learn together.
So you're saying
there are literally thousands and tens of thousands and millions of people that are going out and doing, you know, just this volunteer work. For this volunteer work to be a deeper experience, I think you've got to take the experience and really work with it. A mistake we often make is that, well, those are special people doing special work and I can't do that. We can all do this. And we can do it at the level that, you know, that we're able to do it. And, you know, as we talked about earlier, finding the right spot or finding the right thing that fits you just enhances the work, whether you want to be direct service or education or advocacy or management or what have you. You know, that helps enhance the experience, but it doesn't mean you've got to, you know, do it in any kind of formulaic way.
What would you say some of the greatest joys or the things that actually nurture you, the things you feel best about in doing this service work has been for you?
The greatest thing for me is to bring people together.
Uh-huh.
and to develop trust and better understanding between people. That's my work. Food is the tool that I use. But my greatest sense of accomplishment is if I can get people who have never known each other, maybe didn't respect each other, didn't understand each other, if we can find a way for them to have, you know, find their, you know, common thread of what connects them, then that's a great feeling for me. I like to get things done. I'm a high accomplishment person. So I like to, another way to say it is I like to make things better. We often, I think, get caught with thinking there's a right way and a wrong way, you know, and make it very black and white. You know, we all live in this gray area. And by making things better, you know, another way to express it is to take things to their highest purpose. Now, who knows what that highest purpose is, but if you're moving in that direction, you know, where you're taking something and it's growing and learning and more accepting of each other. You know, the world is calling out for it right now. You know, we're very conflicted because we're letting the extremists in our different religious traditions, you know, define our relationships right now. So there's a huge call of humanity right now to find out what we have in common, our common purpose. A huge call for that work now. And it doesn't have to be at international conferences with the UN. It can be right on the streets or right in your congregation, or right in your place of business.
Well, can you give an example? Like right in your business or right on the street?
This week we're going to have a hunger walk in Atlanta. People have walks all over, you know, all over the country. So a walk is a walk. It's a good way to raise money.
Yeah.
You know, in our case, we are very intentional about bringing the different faith traditions there. And, you know, people come in their traditional dress. They set up their own tents. They're able to bring their own food. I mean, we have a real emphasis on people being who they are and then bringing them together for a common purpose.
Do you ever see a situation where you get them to actually relate to one another?
All the time.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you ask a while ago, what kind of warms my heart? That really warms my heart. It's not just a hunger walk. It's nice to have a walk. It's not just a way to raise money. It's always good to raise money and apply it to a good purpose. The higher purpose for me is to bring people who would never walk together, who would never be, you know, shoulder to shoulder. And, you know, at this time in our life and in the world, getting Christians and Muslims and Jews to be hand in hand walking down the street for a common purpose, that feels like a good day.
Yeah. Have you ever actually had any kind of joint or collaborative adventures that were not just started by you, but by all the groups coming together to start?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, you could have a situation where maybe several groups have decided to come together and to create something together, or you could have something where one voice or one organization calls people together. And in your situation, where whether it's on a national or at a local level, have you generally, is it that your group, the Atlanta Food Bank, makes a call and people come together, or are there situations where various groups get together and say, let us do this thing? and you find yourself joining?
Well, sure. You know, in Atlanta, and it's no different than any other city, that oftentimes different faith groups will come together, small groups of people, in pilgrimage together. That means they go somewhere. Oftentimes, if it's a faith group, they might go where all the faith groups are represented, you know, in this case, the Middle East. But if you do a trip like that and you have to eat together and you mix it up and share rooms together and you pilgrimage together and you worship in each other's holy places, you study and share with each other, some real transformation happens.
I bet.
You do the same thing, you know, around different ages of people, you know, around, certainly around people's different orientation or people's race. You know, it's a little scary if we just decide, you know, I'm a white person and I want to know some black folks. You can't just walk out on the street and say, you know, I've decided I want to meet you and know more about you. Usually that doesn't work very well.
Yeah.
So, you know, having some organized way to do that that feels safe, but at the same time challenges us to get out of our comfort zone. You know, that's really what I'm talking about. And, you know, getting out of our comfort zone is almost un-American.
Well, can you give an example of what you just talked about, for instance, just between the two basic races, black and white, where people, you experience people really being able to relate to each other in a place of non-fear, in a place of interest or intrigue?
I think going to each other's place of worship is a good place to start.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you often hear about how others worship, how they may worship in an African-American church. They may hear how you worship if you're a Lutheran or a Jew. I think the actual experience breaks down a lot of barriers.
Uh-huh.
And what you find is, you know, that we really are worshiping the same God.
Have you done that? Have you gone?
I do it regularly.
Uh-huh.
And
what's your experience when you go into an Afro-American church?
In almost all cases, I'm embraced. They're happy to have me there.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're just happy to see some white folks, like to come and worship with them.
I see.
You know, real interesting experience is to go preach in a black church.
Have you done that?
I've done that, and it's you know, how you often hear in the black church where there's a call and a response.
Yeah, right.
And the congregation responds.
Yeah, right.
They make a real preacher out of a white person.
Do they?
Yeah.
You got some responses?
I've got responses, and it really touches something deeper in yourself.
Yeah, like what happened to you when you got a response? Did you get scared?
Well, I kept preaching.
You kept preaching.
Yeah. You know? And, you know, if you go
you preach
into
a little faster.
I preached longer and faster, and it came from a deeper place. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, it's like having encouragement.
Uh-huh. Did you get into a cadence with them?
I did.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, that's amazing.
And, you know, I've here in Atlanta, I go to Hindu temples. They're you know, the men sit on one side, the women sit on another. They, you know, they hold different traditions than me.
Yeah.
They're very compassionate with me being there, not knowing how everything goes. They love for me to be there. Same way in a mosque.
Yeah. So if a group of people that, let's say, one of the local Universal Awakening chapters might have quite a few people, actually, of our generation. In fact, I would imagine mostly. And if they wanted to, they had some extra time and they wanted to do something, what would be your suggestion of how they go about doing it in terms of service?
Well, I think it's first to talk among yourself and say, you know, to kind of get a consensus of what we'd like to go do. Find a way to do it together. I think that's important.
You mean actually go out together?
Go out together, you know, particularly when you're first kind of going out. Find a place that'll take us as a group. I mean, you know, we'll take a group. Any kind of group, you know, at a food bank, they'll usually take 10 of you or 20 or 30 of you and work, you know, shoulder to shoulder. If you were wanting to go to another place of worship, call the imam up or call the rabbi and just say, you know, there's a group of us. We'd like to come and worship. When would be the best time?
That's
is there anything we
idea.
Need to know before we come, and I just can't imagine they wouldn't respond in a positive way.
Surely, yeah.
You know, there's also, I think, an important part of what we're talking about, and that is kind of the action-reflection model of learning. Oftentimes, you know, if you've got a day to be together, you'd say, well, let's go out and work for 7 hours, and then we'll, you know, we'll go and have a cup of coffee and talk for a few minutes about what happened.
Yeah.
I really suggest people kind of splitting the time. If you're going to spend the day together, go out and do something for 4 hours, and then spend 4 hours talking about what happened.
Uh-huh.
And you know, go deeply. You know, how did it line up with your own values? You know, was it threatening in any kind of way?
Uh-huh.
What did we hear? What did we learn?
Yeah.
What kind of questions do we end up with?
Yeah.
We usually shortchange that part of the work.
Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering, when you're thinking about the world today, well, the first thing I heard you say, and I'm not sure you said it, but so I want to clarify that, and that is it sounded that you to me like you said, well, actually this volunteer service orientation is a, in terms of large group movement, is relatively new, like in the last 20 years. Is that what I heard you say?
That's been my experience.
That's been your experience.
You know, at least particularly around food and feeding.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, I'm wondering, that's encouraging, actually, when you think about it.
I think it's very encouraging. And I think we have a whole generation of folks, you know, who are kind of coming through and maybe coming to retirement time or maybe 10 years out, who have a tremendous amount of experience and skills and resources, not just financial resources, but relationships and contacts and so forth, that all those are assets that we bring with us and that we kind of put on the table and can use.
Well, I have two thoughts about this. One is I'm wondering about when I think about what I'm hearing you say, my first question would be, well, in terms of what you know, the food industry and caring for people through food, would you say that, and I, you know, you'd mentioned earlier the difficulty or the challenge of trying to get younger people involved, and that made me wonder if the majority of people involved in this wave of caring through feeding are people in their 40s, 50s, 60s. Are they more of a, what you'd normally call older generation, or at least middle age?
Well, I think that has been true, but also I'm so hopeful about the younger generation.
Okay.
The kids that we're working with in high school and colleges, fraternities, sororities. I mean, you know, sometimes you think that, you know, they're not out there to serve. It's really the orientation of a fraternity or sorority is of service. I'm so hopeful, one, because young people are asking different questions. They're looking at, you know, an issue that maybe we've worked with for years and say, well, you know what, maybe there's a different approach to this. Maybe there's a different way to do it. And, you know, that's exactly what we did 30 years ago.
Surely, yeah.
So we shouldn't be threatened by it. We should be encouraged by it.
Yeah.
And I find them, you know, tremendously courageous. Maybe a little naive, but, you know, naivete is what got me into this work. And
right.
You know, you need to support them and let them go at the same time. So I find the opposite of what the media would lead you to believe. You know, things are depressing and we feel cynical about the future. I have put myself in a place where I see hope every day, and I see a lot of hope with young people, you know, coming along.
Well, I'm wondering, what do you find the most successful way of igniting young people's fire regarding this?
Being a good listener.
Uh-huh.
Being, you know, bringing together and you know, being very careful not to assume that they're interested in anything you know or the way that you're going to share it. I think bringing people together and, you know, and in my case, it usually involves food and it might involve a meal and, you know, that'll bring anybody together if you feed them. But, you know, being a good listener and saying, you know, have you got an idea about this? You know, young people are very entrepreneurial today. I think much more than we were 30 years ago. You know, they'll just take something and run with it. I think we, as the elders, are responsible for being sure they don't get off track and they don't get in an unsafe place, but we don't need to hold them back. We need to support them.
Another area that I'm wondering about, listening to you and seeing how, at least in the food, carrying through food movement that it may have been in the last, 30 years, that there's been a bigger and bigger engagement on the part of people in that. I wondered if you see today areas that are beckoning service that haven't really been touched or people have overlooked or you wish somebody would more.
I would say that there's a tremendous need to understand our interconnectedness. Now, what I mean by that is if you're in a ministry of feeding folks, I think it's important to ask, where is that food coming from? Who's growing it? Why do we need bigger food banks? Why don't we just pay people a living wage and they could buy their own food? To start looking at some of the systemic issues. Food is very related to the ecology and the environment. So I see them running really parallel, and they often kind of work in their own camps. But you can't be interested in food without being interested in what's happening with the environment and global warming and how much fertilizer we're using and, the mega companies that are driving out small farmers. All these things are connected with each other. I think if you're open and you kind of follow your heart and, follow your experience, oftentimes you'll surprise yourself and say, gosh, I've just discovered a whole aspect of this work that I didn't know anything about, but it really does speak to me, or it may speak to my experience where I have some competencies that I have a place to really contribute.
I'm wondering also where I know that you've talked a lot about faith-based initiatives and you've talked about spiritual community. I'm wondering where you see the relationship between service and the sacred or the spiritual. I mean, that may be an obvious to you, but I want to ask it anyway.
I would answer in this way. There is no way to sustain yourself in this work without understanding the sacred. You'll burn out. You'll get cynical. You'll just feel overwhelmed if you don't understand the deeper side of the work. I think we're all called in our own way, but we have to be very careful not to judge, the way different people are called.
Surely. Well, when you say understand the sacred, for you, what does that mean?
It means if I'm working with the poorest of the poor, I understand that they are loved by God just as much as I am. They may be in the perfect place for themselves in that given moment. So I kind of learning to live with paradox, that everything is perfect in any given moment, and at the same time, we're called to change it, to make it better, to work toward its highest purpose. So you're living, with this paradox all the time.
You're saying that you see people that are in the street with no home, or people that are strung out on drugs or starving as being in a perfect situation?
I do.
Can you say a little bit more about that? What's perfect about that?
They may be in a perfect place to learn exactly what their life lesson is. And, some of us learn it the hard way, and some of us, it comes very easily. I've devoted my life to trying to get them off the street, get them fed, and get them healthy. And at the same time, I have seen so many people that I've worked with where removing them from the situation they're in means that they miss the lesson. So you have to be very careful, when you go out and, quote, try to save people. You have to be very, very careful that you understand their context and what it is that's going on in their life.
Well, how would you know when it's appropriate to intervene? Or how would it be appropriate to intervene?
You don't always know.
So what is your compass? I mean, what do you do?
I listen to them.
Oh.
And I don't assume that I know. You know, I have to say that some of my greatest teachers in my life, some of the greatest lessons I've learned have come from people that, you know, didn't look like they had anything to offer me at all. You know, those are the teachers, you know, not the teachers in the big pulpits or the teachers that, you know, are running corporations or whatever. I mean, teachers are everywhere in our life. You know, that's why learning to take some risk and go out there and keep our eyes open, our ears open, trying to, you know, engage folks. You know, I just have found that so rich in my own life, and it's, you know, probably where I've learned some of my greatest lessons.
Well, I want to thank you for this time together. It's been very enriching for me personally. I'm wondering, as we're about to close, if there's anything more that you would like to add or say to finish things off.
Well, I'm very hopeful that Universal Awakening can be a place that we can have these kind of conversations. You know, those of us who have maybe succeeded in starting organizations or whatever often get held up, but it's the thousands and thousands of people that do the work on the ground that, you know, make all these things work. So I truly believe, in my experience has been, we all have something to offer. We all have valuable lessons that we've learned. So, you know, having a place to have these kind of dialogues and shared experiences, able to work together, I think is very valuable.
Well, we're going to, on that note, we are going to be initiating soon a chat room that'll be specifically addressing the issues of service and the sacred. So we'll see how that goes.
Good. I'm glad you're doing it. Glad we're doing it.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot.
Take care.
Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
Right.
Thank you for being with us at The Meeting Place Live. I invite you to check in with us in about 2 weeks for our new podcast, which will be discussing Awakening Through Science. Our guest at that time will be Dr. Roger Nelson, who directs the Global Consciousness Project at Princeton University. At the bottom of the website page, you'll see a comment button. I invite you to hit that button and share with us your thoughts, and I encourage you to read the comments of other people as well. I want to close this session with a monthly meditation. We're so often busy in our day, and we look for that pause that truly refreshes, and I'm not talking about Coca-Cola. And I have a brief meditation to offer you about this. It takes less than 45 seconds, and it can bring you to a place of clarity, harmonious thought and feeling, a deeper appreciation for life, and awakening to what's truly going on around you. I call this practice sipping light. First, close your eyes and watch the breath going in and out of your nostrils for a moment. Imagine that you are a crystalline chalice, and now open your eyes and look into the light outside a window, or if you're outside, just look into the light in the sky around you. Don't look directly at the sun, but look at the quality of light around you. And as you breathe in, imagine you're breathing in through your eyes and sipping that light, that quality of light from the sky around you into you, filling up this crystalline goblet of yourself through your eyes on every inhalation. Each time you breathe in that light. And then when you feel your self filled with that light, close your eyes and be aware of how that light is affecting you emotionally and how it's fed and clarified your mind. If you would do this practice of sipping light, which is really just a few seconds, different times of the day, different days of the week, different weeks of the year, one of the things you'll begin to notice is that there are many different qualities of light, and that each one affects you emotionally and mentally in many different ways, in many unique ways. And in time, you develop what I would call a palate of light. Just like for those of you who may drink wine, you begin to taste different wines and you have information that you've received from all the wines that you've tasted before to help you discriminate and understand the information that wine is offering you. is equally true with light. The more you do this practice, the more you're aware of what the qualities of light and the space around you, how they affect you, and what kind of information they're trying to pass on to you. Hope you have a great day, and again, thanks for being with us at the Meeting Place Live.